Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I'm finding it very refreshing to find more and more people are finally starting to repeat this, starting to actually say, hey, that debt's fraud. People are actually starting to get smart on what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional. In other words, I'm starting to see more people attuning to the Constitution, but we've got a problem. And welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
Do you know what the problem is, though?
We're not complying with the Constitution.
Well, that is definitely a problem, but there, I'm speaking to a different problem. And the different problem I'm talking about is this selective constitutionality. In other words, there are people that are, oh, well, that debt's fraud, but they're not looking at the education system as fraud. They don't look at the Department of Transportation as fraud. They don't understand that even the Army, as a matter of fact, because I go through this, and even though most people, because of our illiteracy, most people have no idea that the Army cannot be deployed outside of U.S. soil or off of U.S. soil. It is similar to the states have all the authority over immigration and importation of persons. As long as they're not slaves, because the slave trade and the importation of slaves ended in 1808. So, anyway, it's refreshing at least to start finding people that are pulling in, I don't want to call it obscure, but they're starting to pull in these, selective matters of constitutionality instead of just, fighting the progressive side with the conservative voice. And technically, in doing that, they're just fighting over the coin. In other words, the progressives are in control or have had control over this immoral education curriculum and system. And now the conservatives are fighting for control over that coin so that they can create a conservative and, I'll call it trying to make it more of a righteous education system. When the fact is, the coin shouldn't exist. Melt the coin down. Get rid of it. Every state needs to determine what they want to do and how to do it. And I will tell you that we'll probably start finding real awesome ways and very inexpensive ways of educating because we've got technology on our side. Now, I don't know how many teachers are out there, but to be a teacher, you better be doggone good in teaching that material and imparting the truth and knowledge upon the children, because if you're out there grinding agendas, everything's going to be videoed, delivered via the medium of video. So there's no hiding in a classroom with no videos and everything else where you can whisper in the kids' ears and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, nod, nod, and say, this is what you need to do. Don't listen to your parents anymore, kids. This is what you need to do. So anyway, so I find it refreshing that they're out there. But the problem is that they are, only looking at just portions of. This is why constitutional compliance committees are necessary at the county level as well as the state. Because I can tell you, if you've got a corrupt state, they can create a corrupt constitutional committee. And if nobody checks them, if nobody actually holds them accountable, they'll be able to just continue the corruption and, the evil doing. It's only when the committee actually follows the process of what it is supposed to do and actually holds to full compliance to the Constitution as defined, then there we go. There we go. So anyway, we just wrapped up the Articles of Association. Now, they just declared the Declaration of Independence shortly after. And now we're going to war. And actually, we've been at war because the hostilities started in Massachusetts first. And I, you know, I don't want to, you know, pour salt on anybody's wounds. But yeah, I think when you really look at Massachusetts, you know, when you think, Sean, when you think of the Puritans and the state of the Puritans, one would think that it was a beyond reproach, right? One would think.
That's what the name implies, I would think.
Yeah, okay. So why is it that the Puritans were the ones that were unable to actually pay their debt? Because they owed a lot of money because the Union, you know, stepped in and really bailed their butts out because that's where the hostility started. And when we look at the ratification debates, because this will be your first time around when we hit them, but when we go through the Massachusetts ratification debates, you're going to see these anti-federals say, we don't need this. Who cares about the Union? We can do just fine without it. Well, okay, but what about that debt? You still owe the Union a lot of money. Remember, the Shays Rebellion just occurred prior to or during that Constitutional Convention that, you know, literally was a black eye to the Puritans. You know, they took on this debt, and the people said, hey, we don't want to abide by that. In other words, the sentiments of not abiding by the law, when you would think that the Puritans would at least be, you know, wholeheartedly supporting the rule of law. Well, no. In other words, it's almost like they were trying to go down and get their bread buttered on all six sides of the bread. And, well, that never plays well. And it never looks good when people start analyzing, what the heck are you doing? So as we go into the Constitution, and we've basically passed the Constitution, when we get to that point, we're going to find that Massachusetts was one of those states that wanted the federal government to assume their debt so that they wouldn't have to. So that they could share their debt with the rest of the Union, along with some other northern states. What's up with that? So, anyway, I mean, the irony is overwhelming, and you can't wonder. It's kind of like when you see, Christian leadership, families that have been in leadership for a long time, you know, and I don't want to say this disparagingly with the Grahams or anything like that, but there have been other leaders that have fallen just due to the fact that they just went corrupt. And it seems like that is the indictment with Massachusetts, because they're wholeheartedly going down this path of, we want socialism, we want it now. And they've implemented a lot of socialism, things that they shouldn't have been able to do. And basically they're oppressing their own citizens by a form of government that they shouldn't be doing. But all that being said, so we created the Articles of Association, we finished that, and we're now having to fight this war. Well, the reality is that under the Articles of Association, I was very clear right up front that the Continental Congress was exercising powers not delegated. They realized that they needed an instrument that would actually give them power. Well, what went into the convention, now keep in mind, the convention for the Articles of Confederation were during hostile times. I mean, they didn't have this tranquility of being able to be out there, everybody knows where they are, what they're doing, and so forth, right? Like with the convention under the Philadelphia Convention. So they were kind of hasty trying to get this stuff done so the Continental Congress could do its job in prosecuting the war. There was a war going on. So it didn't go out, I want to say somewhere around October 77. So it was a little over a year, I believe. You could probably Google it and look it up to find out when it went out for ratification. I'm pretty sure, I know it was 77, I think it was October. But nevertheless, you know, it went a good season where it took time to get that document done. In contrast to the Constitution being done under tranquility and under the influence and the insights of the divine hand of providence, they did that in 4 months. Wow. As a matter of fact, the ratification of the Constitution took less than a year to do. Wow. It took 2 years almost to ratify the Bill of Rights. Double wow. I mean, the one thing that everybody wanted was a Bill of Rights during the Constitutional Convention. At least the Anti-Federalists were making this facade. We got to have a Bill of Rights. And then when the Bill of Rights came, it's not like they jumped on it really quick, right? So when we look at the difference in the different instruments that came forth for the people of being, you know, for the people of this nation to being governed, the Constitution was just this stellar thing that occurred and was accepted pretty quickly. It's not that it wasn't vigorously debated by the leaders of the cabals of the six, seven states. The fact of the matter is that regardless of what tempest they could brew up, it was not going to be sufficient to suppress or not let this Constitution get ratified. Now, there were two states that didn't join the Union, North Carolina as well as Rhode Island. Rhode Island, I don't think, joined the Union until 1792, but North Carolina joined 1789 after, you know, the new government kind of formed, or 1790, and they actually participated in the second half of that first session. So that being said, you know, the Constitution was pretty quickly embraced. And as we look at the Articles of Confederation, because that's where we're going to focus now, we need to look at the differences of what powers they had. And keep in mind that Continental Congress is a body form, a representative body form of a magistrate. In other words, all powers were vested in Continental Congress. They had legislative powers, they had judiciary powers, and they had executive powers. But their executive powers were strictly and tremendously restricted. They couldn't go out and enforce taxation. They couldn't do things that they truly needed to do, which is one of the reasons why the Articles of Confederation were so defunct and so corrupt. So when we're done with, folks, so just so you know, when we're done with the Articles of Confederation, the next step is the amendments to the Articles. So we're not going to read all of the amendments. We're going to read the entire Articles of Confederation. But we're not going to read all of the amendments, and that's just due to the fact that there are eight of them, and some of them are kind of long. Some of them we will highlight and read, and most of them we'll just kind of talk about. Bottom line, the intent is to show you how inept and how impotent the Articles of Confederation really were. It was just basically lipstick on a pig. So, with that, let's dive into the Articles of Confederation as it was ratified March 1st, 1781. And again, there were two amendments that were basically put out for consideration of ratification to change the Articles of Confederation before it was fully ratified. In other words, they were already finding problems as they were kicking the tires on this thing. So without any further ado, Sean, let's go ahead and I don't want to do the further, you know, the preamble part or the introduction. So let's just start with Article 1.
I just want to let you know that it went out to the states for ratification in November of 1777.
November. Okay, so it took
like 3.5 years it took them.
Right, yeah. So it took a while for them to write the Articles of Confederation. Sounds to me like 14 months. And, you know, I heard this idiot in a county meeting make the assumption that, well, it took 14 years or something like that to write the Constitution. And now that doesn't fly, but nor does this concept of 14 months. The Constitution literally only took 4 months to go in and to literally redesign a new government and to fix the inadequacies of the Union and the general government. So, okay, so with Article 1.
Okay. The title of this Confederacy shall be the United States of America.
Okay, so that right there, actually the style of this Confederacy shall be, I know it says the title, but it says style, not title. And so when we read the Kentucky Resolutions, Thomas Jefferson referred to the U.S. Constitution as a compact and style of the Constitution for the United States of America. In other words, it is a compact in a style like a constitution. They don't call the Articles of Confederation a constitution. I don't know why, but it is a compact because the parties to it had to basically agree. But they never did call this formally a constitution. I think that term became more prevalent and more popular when they started looking at some of the states that actually had constitutions, and constitutions became in or vogue or whatever. So go ahead, Article 2.
Article 2. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled.
Okay, so
they probably should have kept that.
What's that? Go ahead.
I said they probably should have kept that statement.
Well, so actually that right there was reframed into the 12th Amendment, or technically the 10th Amendment.
10th Amendment.
Powers right. not delegated to this government that are not expressly prohibited to the states are reserved to the states and the people, respectively. So
that should have been Article 1, Section 1.
I agree. As a matter of fact, I believe that every state's constitution should have started off with that very same line or the very similar line. The power is not delegated to the state, reserved to the counties and the people. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Go ahead. 3.
Number 3. The said states hereby severally enter into a firm league of friendship with each other for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them or any of them on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or any other pretense whatever.
Okay, so that word is kind of interesting because when you hear the term severally, that's a legal term. And as a matter of fact, the progressive education system considered several law the law of individual, the rights of individuals under the law, which was Roman law, that was several law, was where supposedly the progressives claim that the right of several property was recognized. Now, hold on here. What does that mean? That means that a person could claim property to be theirs and that they would be the sole possessors and the true owners of that property, whether that be a box, whether that be a parcel of land with a home on it, what have you. That was considered several property, independent or, let's just use the word independent for the severalty. The point is that the historians really missed it because Roman law may have been the first to put it onto a piece of paper in a secular form. But I believe when Moses went up onto the mount and God told him, thou shalt not steal, that means that there is a recognition of property for individuals. It's just that you can't steal it from somebody. If somebody's made claim to that, then that you have to challenge their claim. You just can't go along and steal somebody's property. So it was interesting how they take the, you know, in the in the education system. When people look at Rome and Roman law and civil law and so forth, they go, ah, this is so great because look what they did. They did these great, the Bible did that. Anyway, let's go with Article 4.
Article 4, the better to secure and perpetuate mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states in this union, the free inhabitants of each of these states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens in the several states. And the people of each state shall free ingress and regress to and from any other state, and shall enjoy therein all the privileges of trade and commerce, subject to the same duties, impositions, and restrictions as the inhabitants thereof respectively, provided that such restrictions shall not extend so far as to prevent the removal of property imported into any state to any other state of which the owner is an inhabitant, provided also that no imposition, duties, or restrictions shall be laid by any state on the property of the United States or either of them. If any person guilty of or charged with treason, felony, or other high misdemeanor in any state shall flee from justice and be found in any of the United States, he shall, upon demand of the governor or executive power of the state from which he fled, be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of his offense. Full faith and credit shall be given in each of these states to the records, acts, and judicial proceedings of the courts and magistrates of every other state.
Okay, so a couple of things that's kind of interesting, and you probably noticed that, wow, some of this stuff is a part of the Constitution, like this ability to travel freely with the privileges and immunities, you know, respected. And so what's interesting, though, is upon the demand of the governor or executive power of the state from which he fled. Now, apparently only guys commit crimes because, it's, you know, they got a he there. Here's the thing. Not all states had governors, but they had an executive power, which was usually in a representative body. Now, I actually have this all mapped out. This is coming out in my article on the Federalist Papers, and I'm doing this to help set the case of how uniquely different each of the states were and how the Constitution and the ratification debates really clarified, hey, the federal government can't change the form of your government. It must respect your government and adapt to it, to interface with laws, to interface with judicial proceedings and so forth. So here they're basically laying it out that, you know, the governor or any other state. So that's kind of highlighting this fact that there was a difference in forms of government between the states, and that the judicial proceedings and the courts of magistrates of other states as well. So in other words, even the judiciaries, because there were states that had no judiciaries. In other words, the grand council, or I should say the grand court of a particular state like Connecticut, where they didn't have an executive. It was a, at least that I know of. I'd have to go back and look at my records. But there were states that literally just had a legislative body, and they were both the judges as well as the executives. Anyway, just to help you see, you know, what they're saying here, and they're really not delegating power other than the fact that they're talking about how they're going to interface with the travel crimes of people, so forth and so on. So let's go into Article 5 of the Articles of Confederation. Go ahead. Oh, hold on. Hold on. I just noticed what time it is. We just literally have just seconds before we go into break. So okay. Saved by a glance over my shoulder. There we go. We're going into break. So with that, we'll come back and dive into Article 5. But we're going to find the absolute language, almost identical, if not verbatim, that was taken out of the Articles of Confederation into the U.S. Constitution. In other words, the Constitution was not a complete, rejection of the articles. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's go into Article 5. Go ahead, Sean, let's pick it up from there.
For the most convenient management of the general interests of the United States, delegates shall be annually appointed in such manner as the legislatures of each state shall direct, to meet in Congress on the first Monday in November in every year, with the power reserved to each state to recall its delegates or any of them at any time within a year and send others in their stead for the remainder of the year. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, okay, so it was based on 1 year at a time, right? And at the full pleasure of the state. Go ahead.
No state shall be represented in Congress by less than two, no more than seven members, and no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years, nor shall any person being a delegate be capable of holding any office under the United States for which he or another for his benefit receives any salary, fees, or emolument of any kind.
Okay, so let me just jump in on this, too, because when we look, who is dictating who is going to be in Continental Congress?
The states.
The state, but the state legislatures. Mm-hmm. See, all of the states had legislatures, and so all of the representative bodies were the ones that were in control over who was going to be there and how long, and so forth. But they were creating these term limits not to exceed. And they could send, you know, people for 1 year or less than a year even. In other words, the states had a pretty open policy of doing whatever they wanted. 9 months, 9 months. And actually, I don't think Continental Congress was in session every month of the year either. So anyway.
It's pretty plain that the federal government, or this uniting of the states and creating this body, was never intended to have anything to do with the people in the states and their sovereignty and freedom. It had to do with coordination between the states and unity of the states themselves.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. So when we look at the U.S. Constitution, we cover this in the Constitutional Convention. How did they end up creating this bicameral legislative body in Congress? And what they did was they recognized that the people needed to have their own representation, but there should be a separate representation. And in ways, the argument went that there would be a checks and balances between the two bodies, because it's obvious that the people's interest would be benefits to the people. And back in those days, the framers were well aware of Tytler's cycle of democracy. As a matter of fact, Tytler's cycle of democracy was only Tytler stating the obvious of what everybody knew, but he put it in a form that people could learn from because he committed it to paper.
What was the title again?
It's Tytler's T-I-T-L-Y-E-R-S, with apostrophe was somewhere in there, Cycle of Democracy.
Cycle of Democracy.
And you're going to look it up. And This shows a 200-year cycle of why all governments collapse, because even a republic where the people have control, and when they actualize their control over their government, they end up destroying it by granting to themselves more and more benefits, welfare, and so forth. So in other words, eventually the society that is self-governing itself creates more takers than makers, and the society collapses. You never heard the Titler cycle of democracy. That's fine. So
no, sir. I have never heard about it.
Okay. So,
but I have now.
I have now. And so what he did was he laid it out on paper so that people could see and understand this vicious cycle of government. So in forming a republic, this republic that was being created in the Articles of Confederation was doomed to fail, because the people ultimately had control over the legislatures of the states, and then they would ultimately control the legislature of this Continental Congress. That if there were no checks and balances between the desires and the lusts of the people, this government would eventually become a government of welfare, because that's what they all end up doing. But during the Constitutional Convention, this new paradigm created a conflict, or created a balance between the government for the people and the government for the state. See, the states themselves, you know, and it always starts off with the republic, the state is really concerned with prosperity, with, you know, growing revenue and growing, you know, and building up the people's prosperity. Eventually, the people get to a point where they want to get fat and lazy. And that's when they start thinking that, oh, well, we're a rich nation. We can pay for these things. Sound familiar? How many people were listening, you know, from the, you know, not the 30s, not the 20s and 30s or the 40s, but by the 50s and 60s, oh, we're a rich nation now. Look at how prosperous we are. You know, as the richest nation in the world, we should be able to afford to do these things. And they unconstitutionally injected these concepts of democracy by basically allowing government to do unconstitutional things they didn't have the authority to do. So in other words, the framers were well aware of this cycle, this vicious cycle, and they created a government that was limited and defined that couldn't do these things. The only way Titler's cycle could ever be in play in America is for everybody to have an abject rejection of accountability, understanding the Constitution, and holding government accountable. And ergo, they basically encouraged unconstitutionally and allowed the government to start doing things that they didn't have the authority to do. Which means that even though it could collapse at any point in time, the people could actually gain their wits and say, hold on here, you never had the authority to do this. Even though we asked you to do this, or even, actually, it was never that way. It's never been that the people have asked and so forth. It's always been a minority, and it's always been this noble idea, we're going to do this for these people. Oh, yeah, we love that. We're going to do this for those people. It's always been led by progressives and or communists and or socialists, what have you. But bottom line, the states had, at every step of the way, the ability to step in and say, hold on. Sorry. Where do you have this authority in this Constitution to do this? And they never did. Because we became so illiterate and so complacent in holding our governments accountable to the Constitutions. We, by the mid-1800s, had basically embraced this idea that if the Democrats had control, whatever the Democrats legislate, whatever laws they create, it's legitimate. That when the Republicans come in, they can undo that and do what they want to do and allow things to go back and forth, instead of actually saying you can only create laws that are pursuant to the Constitution. In other words, you can only create laws that are pertaining to these objects only, not everything under the sun. And so as they started doing that, well, the courts actually encouraged that. Because by the courts encouraging that, it gave the courts a wider breadth because as government grew, so did the jurisdiction of the court. Because, again, they all wanted to get outside the confines, outside these boundaries. So bottom line, we can kind of see how Tytler's cycle of democracy was actually being actualized. It was coming to a reality in America. But the point is the framers actually created a government that would never have allowed that to happen if everybody did their job. And the real people that are at fault is we the people. You've said this before. Because it is our job to ensure at a minimum that our county is holding the state government accountable. And at the county level, that's where it has to start. That's why we keep on telling you, you got to get active, you got to get involved in your county government. Okay, so let's pick it back up with where you left off on Article 5.
Each state shall maintain its own delegates in a meeting of the states, and while they act as members of the committee of the states. In determining questions in the United States in Congress assembled, each state shall have one vote. Freedom of speech and debate in Congress shall not be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of Congress, and the members of Congress shall be protected in their persons from arrest or imprisonment during the time of their going to and from and attendance on Congress, except for treason, felony, or breach of the peace.
Now, let me just throw this in here, because I like to drive fast. If I was a member of the state legislature, I would be driving ultra fast. I mean, because if I'm going to session, let's say I've got a 200-mile stretch to get to the Capitol, or 300-400. But let's say I'm living in San Diego and I'm going up to Sacramento and I'm on my way to session. That means that I can go as fast as I want. I'm above the law. They cannot stop me and detain me at all on my way to and from. Now, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice that they gave themselves this nice little privilege?
Not for the people who are in the way.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you don't have a wreck, right? And then, you know, all bets are off. Because technically, if you look at the clause in the states today, and I think even in the Constitution, the only time you're not above the law is when you've committed a felony. And if you've killed somebody because you were driving recklessly fast, that would be a felony. And ergo, you could be now held accountable, arrested for murder, reckless, you know, endangerment, whatever, for a felony. And, you know, you can kiss your career in politics goodbye. So you better have, you know, you better be that good of a driver to, you know, to speed to those limits and speeds. But anyway, yeah, I could see myself if you only made the kind of money as a congressman or a legislature in your state to afford a Bugatti, boy, you know, I could get to session fast. Anyway, I digress. Let's go ahead and go into Article 6.
Article 6. No state, without the consent of United States Congress assembled, shall send any embassy to or receive any embassy from or enter into any conference, agreement, alliance, or treaty with any king, prince, or state. Nor shall any person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States or any of them accept any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. Nor shall the United States and Congress assembled or any of them grant any title of nobility. No two or more states shall enter into any treaty, confederation, or alliance, whatever between them, without the consent of the United States and Congress assembled, specifying accurately the purposes for which the same is to be entered into and how long it shall continue. No state shall lay any imposts or duties which may interfere with any stipulations in treaties entered into by the United States and Congress assembled, with any king, prince, or state in pursuance of any treaties already proposed by Congress to the courts of France and Spain.
Okay, so at this point in Article 6, because it continues, it seems like Continental Congress has the corner on making any trade deals at all. That it doesn't mean that states can't, but Continental Congress has to approve. And the only way Continental Congress can approve is, and they get, I think they get into what the decorum is. It doesn't require a majority. I think it requires 9 states, something like that. Not unanimity, but, you know, still a supermajority to allow a state to create a treaty. Well, this right here was the states completely ignored this. The big states like Virginia, Massachusetts, and some of the, I think, North Carolina and some other ones, were creating their own treaties and trade deals. And the state that had the most to offer got the sweetest deals. In other words, there was a huge competition in these trade agreements that they were making with these other nations. Now, you got to remember that at this point in time, we were at war with Britain, so there wasn't a lot of trade being done with Britain. But there sure was with France, Spain, and some of these other nations. So anyway, let's keep going.
No vessel of war shall be kept up in time of peace by any state, except such number only as shall be deemed necessary by the United States and Congress assembled for the defense of such state or its trade. Nor shall any body of forces be kept up by any state in time of peace, except such number only as in judgment of the United States and Congress assembled shall be deemed requisite to garrison the forts necessary for the defense of such state. But every state shall always keep up a well-regulated and disciplined militia, sufficiently armed and accoutred, and shall provide and constantly have ready for use in public stores a due number of field pieces and tents, and a proper quantity of arms, ammunition, and camp equipage. Okay. No state shall engage in any war without the consent of the United States and Congress assembled, unless such state be actually invaded by enemies, or shall have received certain advice of resolution being formed by some nation of Indians to invade such state, and the danger is so imminent as not to admit of a delay till the United States and Congress assembled can be consulted. Nor shall any state grant commissions to any ships or vessels of war, nor letters of marque or reprisal, except to be after a declaration of war by the United States and Congress assembled, and then only against the kingdom or state and the subjects thereof against which war has been so declared, and under such regulations as shall be established by the United States and Congress assembled, unless such state be infested by pirates, in which case vessels of war may be fitted out for that occasion and kept so long as the danger shall continue, or until the United States and Congress assembled shall determine otherwise.
Okay, so it's kind of interesting that much of this language was incorporated in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting that they talk about this well-regulated militia as well, the necessity of doing that. The difference is that the Continental Congress has no, how do you say, they have no involvement financially in the state's militia. Where in the Constitution, Congress has to pay for, equip, and discipline, pay for both the equipping, disciplining, you know, clothing, all of this stuff, the militia, so that the state doesn't necessarily have to carry the burden. Now, the state can, if they want to, spend more money into their well-regulated militia, which would behoove of them to do that. But the federal government, and this goes down the path of how, you know, because I've talked about this before, and I think I've mentioned this with you on the show before, how when the migration from the original states westward began, how the concept of deploying the militia, a federalized army, and I think at this point in time, when they started doing this, going into these new states, i.e. Indiana, I think outside of Ohio, because Ohio, we had the Indian Wars and so forth long before it became a state. And Ohio was basically pumped with, I'll just say, citizens that were former veterans. In other words, people that fought in the Revolutionary War. So they kind of had per capita, they had a high concentration of war fighters compared to other states. And when we look at Indiana and some of these other states joining the Union, not so much. And in some of these other states, like the states in the South, it's kind of interesting how the Indian tribes in the South actually got on board with, you know, working with the people. And I think that, you know, the Cherokee realized that most of the people they were dealing with were pretty uneducated and pretty dense, you know, dumb, whatever. Because it didn't take long. It wasn't until 1830 or whatever when the people got so upset that the Cherokee were beating them. They were dominating the commercial markets. I mean, the paper in the South that was the most popular paper was the Cherokee paper, newspaper. So they basically demanded and clamored that Jackson remove these guys. And so, you know, completely unconstitutional, and that's a rat hole all in itself. But the point is that we kind of look at, you know, in the South, they didn't need to have a militia because the Indians were actually playing the game. They were, you know, they were becoming active participants in this great, you know, capitalistic, or I should say free market system that we were supposed to have. Now, up in the Northwest, now it was a lot different. When I say Northwest, I mean Indiana, Illinois, and those central states. It was a lot different. They, you know, the Indians weren't happy with the progress of white people coming into those territories. So the federal government started deploying this permanent, you know, occupation of the territory. When technically what they should have been doing was they should have been out there equipping, training, and disciplining and getting the people living in that territory aware of their responsibilities. And that right there, they were setting the stage of taking away the people and their responsibility of self-governance and self-enforcement of the law and protection of their own defense system and so forth, and made them lazy and dependent on the good old federal army. Anyway, all right, so Section 6 is done. Now we get into Section 7, which is kind of short, and then I think we'll start, actually it comes into, I think, 9 or 10 when we get into the jurisdiction, but let's do Section 7.
When land forces are raised by any state for the common defense, all officers of or under the rank of colonel shall be appointed by the legislature of each state respectively, by whom such forces shall be raised, or in such manner as such state shall direct, and all vacancies shall be filled up by the state which first made the appointment.
Okay, so they're basically saying up to colonel. The Constitution didn't create a rank, did it?
No.
That the states actually would have the ability to create generals and so forth. In other words, there was no encumberment upon the states in how they wanted to manage their rank structures and so forth. It's only when they were brought into the federal, you know, federalizing the militia into an army, then that federal government would basically get what they were given. Now, I believe that it became problematic because of nepotism and other bad practices. But nevertheless, to change or to fix the problem that may have been occurring in the states because states had that ability to be a bad actor, then it should have required a constitutional amendment. In other words, that the federal government would then dictate ranks of certain, or when they came into the service, that, you know, they would be brought in by the ranks that the federal government saw fit instead of whatever the state did. The point being is that as they kind of went from this into the U.S. Constitution, they actually gave the states plenty of latitude. And they basically laid it out so that even the training, which is kind of interesting because one would have thought that the economy of scale is always better to train people in one state or in one or two locations than to train everybody, you know, in every state, every county, and so forth, because it just increases your cost of trainers, the cost of trainers, training, all that stuff. So my point is that the Constitution clearly dictated that the training needed to be done by the state. So if you're going to be trained an infantryman, a mortarman, an artillery specialist, a fire control, you know, the guys that go out and basically, you know, help click in the artillery, you know, with forward observers.
Yeah, forward observers.
That type of stuff. So anyway, so all these different military occupational specialties that would have needed training, that had to be done by each of the states, which means that that was huge redundancy that the federal government was going to end up having to pay for. Here's the problem. The states never did what they were supposed to do in actually, you know, preparing this militia to the scale of what they should have been doing, because at that point in time, you know, they knew the federal government didn't have the money. Well, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be making requisitions and saying, well, we need to do this, we need to stand up these schools, blah, 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 and drive the federal government with these requisitions so that the federal government would go, oh, okay, we're going to have to, you know, up the game on taxation, whatever. The point is that the states really should have been driving, you know, this development of the militia and the utilization, where the states could have actually taken advantage of that extra federal dollars to create a better law enforcement system than these mercenary forces that they went and adopted on their own. Because now we pay for all of that, and it becomes problematic. Because every mercenary force formed becomes an arguing force to basically disarm you. They do not want a populace with guns. They want a disarmed populace so that they don't get shot. Anyway, any comments? We're basically almost out of time.
No, I was just going to say, it seems like a really hard balance when you think about it, because they wanted the upper officers, the higher officers, the command level officers to be federal. You didn't want states developing these armies with generals and everything. But at the same time, then that leaves all of it in the hands of the federal government. And that's why we ended up having a regular army instead of militia.
That's right. That is correct. So what the U.S. Constitution did was it literally put more of the control back into the hands of the state government. And, I mean, right, wrong, or indifferent, there were plenty of debates, especially in Virginia, where they argued it to ad nauseum. But the fact of the matter is that the federal government had the responsibility of funding this great law enforcement, this great defense system that would have been maintained at the state level. To this day, it would have been a superior form of law and law enforcement had we adopted this design, but we didn't. And I am G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.